Which are the best 5 shares in the world? What do they look like and why are they the best? My name is Hannah Barry, and in today's MoneyWeb webinar, we're going to be discussing just this. Which are the best 5 shares in the world, according to Anchor Capital? At least to help me answer these questions, I have Peter Armitage, who is the CEO of Anchor Capital, with me in studio, as well as Sean Ashton, Chief Investment Officer there. And then Nick Dennis, who's a fund manager with a focus on global equities, joins us on the line. So just a reminder that if you would like to ask questions, you can find the question box on the right-hand side of your screen. Type your question in and we will try and get to as many questions as we can in the last half an hour. To get us going, Sean, won't you tell us which are the best 5 shares in the world? Give us the rundown and then we'll look at these stocks.
Sure, Hannah. So I think we've chosen, it's always a daunting task to be picking the best shares in the world, but I think we've chosen a grouping of stocks that we certainly think will perform well over the next 12 months. Many of them have been performing well already. And it's stocks, just to run through the list, it's Pandora AS, which is a Danish listed jewelry business, affordable jewelry. It's Admiral Group PLC, which is the second largest auto insurer in the UK. It's Skechers USA, which is a shoe business listed in America. Apple Incorporated, many people will be familiar with that one. And Priceline Group.
Is there something, these are very different businesses, as you say, we've got a shoe company, we've got a jewelry business, we have a motor insurer. Is there something common to all of these shares that you like?
I think certainly in terms of our investment process, the kind of things we look for, high returns on capital employed, sustainable ability to deploy capital, those would be common threads throughout most of these companies that we're looking at today.
Okay, then let's pick up with Skechers. I'll start there. Nick, I believe that you are the expert on this business. That company currently at $30 a share, if I'm not mistaken. What is particularly attractive about Skechers and why do you prefer it, let's say, over a Nike?
So Skechers is in a bit of a different bucket to Nike. It's a much smaller business, but it's the number 2 athletic footwear brand in the US. So it's clearly a business with brand equity. Perhaps not at the same level as a Nike or an Under Armour, but it's certainly got brand equity. What makes the stock interesting is that it has been on quite a massive tear over the past couple of years, but then in its third quarter of this year, it missed the sell side earnings estimates, and the stock got clobbered roughly 30% in a day. And so now the stock is trading on about a 15 times 2016 PE, 12 times to 2017 PE. That compares with 29 times PE for a Nike and a 66 PE for Under Armour. Mm-hmm. So then that's despite delivering growth that was still sort of just shy of 30% on the revenue and the earnings per share line. So the underlying business is still growing strongly. I think it was just a case of perhaps people needing to rebase their expectations. But let's say that the share gets to, you know, 20 times forward earnings at the end of next year. This, you know, if we're sitting, you know, having this conversation in a year's time, that takes us to a share price target of around $50, which is 70% higher than today's share price. So that assumes that the business kind of performs strongly. Some of the reasons that the stock sold off were a bunch of one-offs, and you sort of use that in quotations because sometimes one-offs have a way of reoccurring. Mm. But that's it. I mean, there were currency headwinds and some other things, and then there has been some weakness in the department store channel in the US, potentially overstocking with other brands, which affected them. But nevertheless, I mean, the business is delivering double-digit comp sales, which is same-store sales. So if the store, if I sold 100 last year and this year I sell 110, then the business is growing 10% on the same-store sales basis, which is decent in a slow-growing economy. And then they're growing the international business very strongly. So the U.S. still is just under 60% of revenues, and the international business is just over 40%. And they want them to both be sort of roughly 50-50. The business is growing 175% year-on-year in China in the latest quarter. So it's growing strongly. So I think if you, as long as they're able to put in sort of decent, semi-decent performance, I think the stock could have a lot of legs from here, particularly with a huge discount in multiples relative to Nike and Under Armour. And just to put in context, Skechers is a $5 billion market cap stock, whereas Nike's just over $110 billion. So in my mind, Skechers sooner becomes a $10 billion stock than Nike becomes a $220 billion stock. And that's why we think it's interesting. So I'm not arguing that, I would argue that Nike is a better brand and better franchise, but potentially Skechers is the better stock looking into next year.
Okay, so there's something there definitely that the best companies are not necessarily the best stocks or the shares that you want to invest in. The one thing that does strike me about this selection is that all of these are offshore companies. They're all international businesses, global equities. Peter, perhaps you want to jump in here. Why do you think we're seeing perhaps more attractive stocks in the offshore space?
And I think South Africa is a tiny part of global markets. It's less than 1%. So, I mean, to be frank, for this webinar, we wanted to expand people's horizons a little. There's lots of shares in South Africa that we like, and they could possibly claim a place to be in the top five in the world. You know, but locally we're picking for our portfolios from roughly 120 shares. From a global perspective, we're screening up to 6,000 shares. And, you know, these are ones that we're familiar with and we spent some time on. We've engaged with management. And, you know, you asked earlier about what do they have in common. I think what they all have in common as well is we think they could all go up 30 or give a total return of 30% or more.
Wow.
But, I mean, that should be no surprise if we're talking about what we think are the best five shares in the world. There's always shares that can go up 30, 40, 50%. I think one of the important things to emphasize as well from a global share perspective, and Nick highlights it in Skechers, is that the market is significantly more volatile than South Africa. So if a good company misses its earnings numbers by a little or sends out a wrong signal, it's very easy for share prices to drop 20 or 30%. So that presents opportunity from an investment perspective if you've got conviction in a share. But at the same time, we also would suggest to people that offshore and what we do in our offshore portfolios, you know, is to have 20, 25 shares because the unexpected can always happen. So these are shares we really like. But if we put together a portfolio of 20 shares, I can tell you with a fair amount of certainty that in a year's time, a few of them will be down because, you know, Skechers, again, it's a great example. The market was expecting big things. They still come out with good results. But a share price and how it reacts is not about what it's done. It's about what it's done relative to expectations. So if people expect 50% growth and it grows by 30%, it'll be negative for the share price. And often you get management sort of scratching their heads going, I produced 30% growth. Why did my share go down? Well, it's often because they've been creating the expectation of much higher growth.
And as you say, expectations of at least a total return of 30% or more with a share like Apple, which is different to Skechers in that it is a dominant player in the market. It is very large, perhaps more comparable to Nike. Do you really think, Nick, that we will see Apple keep going up and keep delivering growth?
So I think Apple's an interesting case study because, okay, it's the largest company in the world, and you would think that it's got the most eyes in the world looking at it and therefore it should be the most efficiently priced. But what's interesting about Apple is you've got two quite divergent camps looking at the stock. So you've got your bulls, which look at it and say it's a fantastic business, still has, it's got competitive advantages and it's still got a growth opportunity. Then you've got your bears that basically say, well, this is just Kodak version 2 or Sony or Samsung. Where the share price is priced at the moment, to my mind at least, is that the PE is in pricing more in the latter camp. But we're bullish on Apple. We think it's still got a growth opportunity. I think what's interesting is that despite it being such a high profile company, people seem to have lost interest in it relative to what are called the FANG stocks. So FANG is Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google. It's a phrase coined by Jim Cramer. And so these stocks have been on fire. But Apple's sort of been lost by the wayside. And also positioning, there was a study by Morgan Stanley which showed that U.S. fund managers are underweight Apple relative to their benchmarks, which is not the case for Apple and Facebook and Google, rather. So we look at this and we look at the growth expectations for 2016 are muted. The sell side is only expecting sort of 5% revenue growth for the next 2 years and call it high single digit earnings growth. So we think expectations are relatively low. And I think the key question for me when looking at Apple is people think that they always look at the iPhone sale and then say, what next? And they even seem to question the sustainability and longevity of those iPhone earnings streams. So we view this more as an annuity type business. We think the whole Apple ecosystem with the iOS and iTunes and these other services that they're adding on, Apple Pay and Apple Watch, do more to lock people into that ecosystem.
Mm.
And so we think this creates a recurring revenue stream. So if the mindset changes to this being more of an annuity business rather than a one-off kind of commoditized business, then we would argue that this deserves to trade on a higher multiple than it does. And we've seen how large cap growth, large cap stocks such as Google and Microsoft have had terrific runs in 2015. I think it's completely possible that that Apple has a similar kind of year in 2016, as people see either that they go and they beat earnings expectations, or people don't see the drop off in sales that the bears might be expecting. And they've got it's got a 10% free cash flow yield, and if they got cash on the balance sheet and a free cash flow yield, they could virtually buy back the company in 8 or so years. I mean, there's difficulties around repatriating the cash to the US, but that conceptually just shows you that with some smart capital allocation, you don't need a lot of growth to actually get interesting returns as a shareholder. So, we think if Apple trades up to a 14 times multiple on 2017 earnings, so if we were sitting here in a year's time looking forward, that's still trading at a discount to the S&P 500, which is trading on more 16, 17 times forward earnings. And that gives you upside of roughly 30%, which for a very, very high quality company, we think is an interesting return.
Okay, let's leave Apple there and move to Pandora, which I imagine being a discount jewelry business and slightly cheaper than some of these other stocks probably does have room for growth, Sean.
Absolutely, Hannah. So this business is really in the affordable jewelry market. So a typical price point could be $50 for a charm that you might want to add to a bracelet that you wear. Many listeners may be familiar with the product. And a bracelet itself may cost $150. So that's kind of the price point we're talking about, very much affordable jewelry. And I think as a brand, it's gaining significant traction globally, and specifically in developed markets like the US, where it's now 30% of their sales. They've recently signed up into a strategic collaboration with the Walt Disney Company to co-brand Disney branded charms, for which they've now extended that to Asia Pacific following the success that they achieved in America. So I think you've got some fairly high profile large corporates that are pinning their badge to this brand. So I think as a brand, it's gaining traction globally. Just to take a bit of a step back, I mean, this is a company that had quite a few serious missteps when you look back to 2011 and 12, the fiscal year ended 2012, where what they really tried to do was push more higher end products, more gold jewelry, and the price points got ahead of them. And they also pushed too much of this inventory out into what was largely still then a wholesale channel in terms of their sales force. And the net result was that they actually had to take a lot of that inventory back and take write-downs on it. So you saw a massive earnings retracement in the 2012 financial year as sales stalled, and they took a write-down in inventory. That they made management changes. They went back to basics, producing the traditional charm jewelry that they produce, got their price points right, and the net effect is that sales have been exploding in the last few years, literally 30% compound growth. And there's another factor that also plays into it, and it comes through from a bit of a macro theme that us as a house, Anchor Capital, have been quite negative on resources prices. And that plays quite nicely into Pandora's business model in the sense that as you have falling gold and silver prices, so their gross margins expand. Mm. We think a lot of that has happened now. You've had margins that have risen from 22% at the EBIT level to 35% today. So I think the margin expansion story has largely run its course, but you've still got a business here that's sustaining 20% more than 20% turnover growth, which is underpinned by their decision to invest in branded stores, not just wholesale stores, a lot of which they own. So their store numbers are up 14% globally in the third quarter, and they continue to roll out stores and still achieve positive same-store sales growth. So that's the measure of brand success. Are you cannibalizing existing stores or not? And certainly there's no evidence of that yet. So we think the margin story has run its course, but here you've got a business which is trading at a forward 18 PE. Bearing in mind, we invested for our clients at about 218 Danish kroner about 2.5 years ago. It's now 860, so it's run very hard. But yeah, the rating is still at a reasonable level, and we think this is a business that can carry on growing its earnings by at least 20% a year for a couple of years. So I think at that rating, you should expect to see largely earnings growth plus dividend as a total return.
We do have some questions from listeners. Let's try and get to some of those. One from Werner Lanz, who asks, will these be the offshore shares that Astoria will typically invest in? Peter, you can jump in there. Just a reminder to our listeners that Astoria is effectively an investment company that's listed, has a secondary listing here on the JSE, a primary listing in Mauritius, and it essentially gives access to offshore equities. It invests in offshore equities itself. Is that correct?
Yeah, so it's a share that you can buy on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, which effectively is 100% offshore equities through direct equities, through niche funds, and through private equity funds. So Anchor Capital is the asset manager of Astoria. So I guess it would be no surprise if these are our picks to find them in that portfolio. When they go in and when we invest in them is a function of timing and watching the share prices. So we, being the asset managers, it's a listed business. We're not at liberty to tell you about every single trade that we do. The directors of Astoria have to put out SEN statements to do that. But I think it would be a logical conclusion that our top five shares would find their way into the Astoria offshore equity portfolios.
Admiral Group is an interesting one. It's not universally loved by analysts, it doesn't seem. Of the 16 analysts covering the group, three would say it's a buy, six a sell, and 10 a hold. So kind of a bit of a mediocre opinion on the company. A Welsh motor insurance business, $1,634 a share. Sean, what's nice about this company?
I'm glad you introduced it by talking about the consensus expectations, because that's part of the reason we like it. I think analysts have been bearish on this company for the last 2 odd years. It's a business we identified in late 2013 as a potential investment. We invested in it. We're probably up about 20% or so in terms of capital gain, but that ignores the dividend stream that you've got. And that's significant. And I think just this is a wonderful business. You can almost view it as the outsurance of the UK. They're the second largest auto insurer in the UK. They don't have a big fancy London head office. Everything's done out of Cardiff. They're very scientific in the pricing of business that they're prepared to write. So they will very happily turn away low quality business. So a very disciplined management team that has a very significant shareholding in the company. And at the same time, so very data driven. And this shows up the effect of their discipline around capital management, around pricing, and the fact that they have scale shows up in the expense ratio. So when you're an insurer and you're selling insurance policies, your competitive advantage really is cost and scale ultimately. And this is where Admiral, they run an expense ratio, which is really the overheads measured as a proportion of the premiums that they write. Their expense ratio is about 15%. Which is roughly half of that of the broader sector. So they can sustainably run at a more profitable level than the auto industry in general. And I think certainly you had many years of kind of double-digit dividend and profit growth out of this company, which over the last 2 or 3 years has stalled. Now, why is it stalled? It's stalled because you've had quite a tough premium cycle in the UK. So you've had a lot of competition for writing auto insurance business in the UK. It's had the net result is that auto premiums dropped by, I think, at their peak in the first quarter of 2014. At an industry level, they would have been down by about 20% year on year. So there's been intense competition in premiums. And we're now starting to see that cycle turning. So the premium cycle's moving up. You've got a quite nice pricing power returning to the business. So that's an environment in which they will price up, but they will tend to gain market share because they won't price up to the extent that their competitors have to, because their competitors are all running at a loss. So you would expect to see them gaining market share. They make very extensive use of reinsurance arrangements, so it's a very capital light business. They tend to sustain a return on equity of more than 50%. And I think what's also quite attractive is the accounting seems to be very conservative in the sense that they build up reserves for expected losses that tend to always be too much. So you have this pattern of reserve releases every year, which basically is telling you that they're accounting your earnings as understated every year. Mm. And that results in them always being a bit more overcapitalized than they need to be. And hence, they tend to pay out very, very generous dividends as measured by the cover on the earnings that they report. So they've paid out virtually all of their earnings as a dividend every year for the last few years. And the net result of that is when you're buying it today, I think the share price is about £16 or thereabout. You're paying a forward 16 PE, but you're getting about a 6% dividend yield. So you're getting a 6% dividend yield into an environment where consensus expectations over the next 2 or 3 years for growth are very muted. The market's looking for about 3% compound growth between FY15 and 18. I think on the balance of probability, they'll probably deliver more than that. So there's upside surprise potential to consensus. And you paid very handsomely to wait. A 6% dividend yield in pounds is very attractive.
Absolutely. And just a correction there on the share price. I got it wrong. Got my wires crossed. £16 a share, more or less, is what Admiral Group is going for. I'm sure our listeners are dying to hear exactly how we should be best investing in these stocks. We do have some questions coming through on the webinar, but I would ask you to keep it to the topic of these stocks and particularly just investing and selecting the best shares in the world. Let's just look finally at Priceline Group and then we'll move on. Nick, this is an online travel company, also fairly expensive to my mind from a share price point of view. What do you say is sort of is this company offering?
So the share price itself is quite high, so it's around $1,300, but then the per share earnings are high too. So actually it's quite inexpensive in terms of a PE multiple, put it that way. So Priceline's on about a 19 times forward PE, and it delivers about a 34% return on equity. So it's a very high quality business, and trading at what we think is an inexpensive multiple. But the jewel, and so as you said, Priceline is an online travel agency, and the jewel in the crown of Priceline is Booking.com, which listeners might recognize. So when you do your hotel booking, you're looking for places to stay, you go onto Booking.com. And online travel agencies are taking share from offline travel agencies, and then Priceline, as the leader in the market, is growing faster than the other online travel agencies. And what it shows what we find in a lot of tech companies, where you create this virtuous circle where size begets size and creates a network effect. So the largest company attracts the most hotel properties, and in turn then that attracts the most customers. And then because more people come on to transact on the site, then that leads to more revenue for Priceline, which they can reinvest in the business through say advertising on Google search. So they would spend, call it, close to $3 billion. That's what their marketing budget is. And so as a smaller player, it's very difficult for you to compete with that. To give you a sense of Priceline's growth, roughly 18 months ago, they had 500,000 properties on Booking.com. Now it's over 800,000 properties with 21 million rooms. And what's interesting is within their existing properties, they've only got mid-single-digit share of the total bookings. So we think there's room for Booking.com to take share within their existing clients, and for them to sign up in new properties, and for online to take share from offline. What's interesting about Priceline is that though it's listed in the US, around 90% of operating profit is actually generated outside the US. So in US dollar terms, the strong dollar this year has actually been a significant headwind in terms of profitability. Mm. So If in 2016 the dollar isn't as strong as it was this year, then what the major headwind has been removed, and you can see dollar earnings grow quite smartly again. And we think you could also potentially see a PE re-rating. So we don't see any reason why I can't trade at a similar PE multiple as, say, Google. So Google trades on 23 times. If over the next year it trades up to 23 times forward PE, that would imply 30% upside on a one-year horizon. And even at that multiple, for a very high-quality growth company with significant competitive advantages, we think that's quite reasonable.
Doesn't look to me that like the dollar is going to weaken, but let's not get into that debate. Quickly, Nick, we have a question from a listener, Ian Gibson, wanting to know whether Airbnb is a threat to Priceline. Or to Booking.com, I suppose, specifically.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Potentially, there is overlap. So first, I would say I think both have an opportunity to grow. But I'd also argue that the customer that is looking for a hotel room is arguably someone that is different from the customer that is looking for self-catering, which is what you go for in Airbnb. That aside, I mean, we still think that there's a long runway of growth for both companies. The offline is still, I think the number is 60% of the market in the U.S. and higher internationally. So there's still a long runway of growth there. But yes, I'd say at the margin there probably is some overlap, and theoretically Airbnb could serve to slow down Priceline's growth rate. But it's not going to, I don't think it will disrupt the business model altogether.
Peter, let's look a bit at how one actually invests in these stocks. Outside of Anchor, what's the best way to go about getting access to these shares?
Not sure there is any way outside of Anchor, isn't it?
No, jokes aside. So ultimately, you can have a direct share portfolio. So that's obviously something that we do. Or there are, you know, there's lots of different providers in South Africa, the likes of the Saxos and the RG Markets, or through your local stockbrokers. Typically, they've got some mechanism for people to invest offshore. So you can have a stockbroking account. The second thing you need is the ability to transact offshore, and your stockbroker will typically facilitate that for you, either through an asset swap, and which will cost you some additional money. The ideal is to apply to the South African Revenue Service and get permission to take money offshore and actually have a direct offshore share portfolio. Alternatively, you can buy a local unit trust which has investments in offshore equities, and there's a range of about 50 of those. I mean, most big asset management companies have an offshore equity unit trust, so we've got one, which is actually a feeder into Nick Dennis's fund, who was speaking earlier. He runs the Global Equity Fund. So you'll find quite a few of these shares from time to time in his portfolio. So you can choose to employ it with a professional fund manager who's going to pick the shares, or you can invest directly in a share portfolio, which most stockbrokers will facilitate.
Some fund managers are cautioning investors against sending all their money offshore, which I think some South African investors may be prone to do in these tough economic times, for simple reasons that the rand is very weak. So you're buying these companies at a very expensive price. So you're at a disadvantage. What would you say to that, Peter, in terms of getting that offshore exposure, but understanding that you're not getting that much bang for your buck?
Well, two things. If you were sitting on the moon and looking down at Earth, you wouldn't point at South Africa and say, I want 99% of my money at the tip of Africa. It makes sense, no matter where you are in the world, even if it is America, to diversify your portfolio, and because currencies and the unexpected can happen. So different markets can do well or badly, currencies can move. So to have some diversification has merit. And the second thing I would say is you've got to just take a very clear view on where the rand dollar will be in 5 years' time. We've got a very high conviction level that it'll be materially weaker than where it is today. You have had a big spike in the currency, so there's a strong possibility that it could come back to the 13s or the 12s over the course of the next 6 or 12 months, but we think that's largely irrelevant. If you look at the rand over any 20-year period, you've had 4 or 5% depreciation per annum, and that adds up pretty quickly. Mm. So I think the starting point is, do you have any investments offshore? If you don't have any, there's hardly ever a bad time to diversify. So if you had none, we would suggest taking 30-40% of your money and investing it in offshore assets. If you've already got that, now might not be the ideal time to invest offshore if you've got a short-term view. If you've got a longer-term view, you know, the plethora of opportunities offshore is just so dramatically bigger than South Africa. You know, it makes a lot of sense to do it.
Here we go. And as you mentioned earlier, 6,000 shares that Anchor Capital is investing in offshore versus 120 locally. We are going to have to leave it there for today. We've come to the end of this MoneyWeb webinar on the best five shares in the world. I was joined by Anchor Capital CEO Peter Armitage, as well as Sean Ashton, who is Chief Investment Officer. And then Nick Dennis was on the line. He's a fund manager with a focus on global equities. If you would like to listen to this webinar again or read the text and just get into the nitty-gritty of some of the details of these stocks, it will be up on the MoneyWeb website tomorrow, moneyweb.co.za. Otherwise, that's it from us, and thanks very much for joining us.